Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is called Ki Tetze, when you go out. It is from Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 10 to Deuteronomy 25:19. The Haftarah is Isaiah 54, verses 1 to 10, and the Brit Hadashah is Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 to 30, and 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 1 to 5. Let's say a word of prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu Melech haolam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe. We thank you and praise you for your Sabbath, for your word, for Yeshua, our Messiah, our soon coming King. I just ask that you would be in everything that I say, that nothing that I say from my own flesh would come forth and flourish, but only your words, only what you want to have said would come forth and flourish, and let none of your words come back void. I pray in Yeshua's name. Amen. Okay, so there's a difference here in Ki Tetze, when you go out. There's a difference in this Torah portion compared to the other Torah portions. A lot of people say that these commandments in Deuteronomy, some of them are new commandments. I disagree with that. I think that that is a simplified way of looking at these scriptures, because right here in this Torah portion are some of those so-called new commandments. Well, here's what I believe they are. I believe that they are situational commandments that use the principles of the commandments that have been given. In other words, the Lord has said, you shall do this and you shall not do that. And now he's telling you how that would apply. So these are not new commandments, but they show you how to use the principles of the commandments that are already given so that you can apply them appropriately to your everyday life. As we go through this, I'm going to try to give you some examples of the principles that might be associated with these situations. In Deuteronomy 21:10, it says, if you go to battle against your enemies and the Lord your God delivers them into your control, you may take some prisoners captive. If you see among the prisoners a beautiful woman and you desire her, then you may take her as your wife. Bring her to your house, but shave her head and trim her nails. Remove her prisoner's clothing and let her remain for a month in your house, mourning her parents. After that, you may become her husband and she is to become your wife. If you are not pleased with her and you send her away, you must not sell her for money or mistreat her, since you have dishonored her. The principle here is on how to treat a foreigner or even our enemies. This woman here in this situation is from a conquered territory. Those people were your enemies. You conquered them. She's a foreigner. She's been forced to come into your home. But she is given an opportunity to go through the rite of passage, shaving her head and trimming her nails. That's a rite of passage from one culture to another, so that hopefully after she shaves her head and trims her nails, she will not be a foreigner anymore, but will want to become a stranger, which is, you know, as I've taught in other Torah portions, a stranger is someone who is kind of in that in-between spot. They're no longer a foreigner, and the laws of foreigners don't apply to them anymore. Strangers and the natural-born citizens of the kingdom all live under the same rules. The foreigners don't necessarily live under all of those rules. There's some differences that are talked about here in this Torah portion. So hopefully she becomes a stranger, which is the person who is actually making the transition from being an enemy, a foreigner, to being a full-fledged citizen of the kingdom. You know, the stranger is that person in transition. That is precisely what the shaving of the head and the trimming of the nails is all about for her. It's that rite of passage, transitioning from being a foreigner to hopefully wanting to be a stranger. The final test of whether or not she will remain with her captor is whether or not she is pleasing to him. And the scripture isn't very clear about why, you know, he would be or would not be happy with her. Apparently that isn't as important as much as how he treats her if he is not pleased with her. You see, there's this thing about mercy here, that if she is allowed to mourn her parents for a month and he takes her as his husband and doesn't and is not pleased with her, he can't just sell her and he can't mistreat her in any way. He has to be respectful and merciful towards her. So the principle here is mercy toward everyone. Deuteronomy 24:1 says, if a man chooses to enter into marriage with a woman, but she finds herself displeasing to him because he has found something objectionable about her, he must draw up divorce papers, hand them to her, and then send her out of his house. Now, this is a little bit different commandments regarding the principles of marriage and divorce. The first woman in Deuteronomy 21 comes to him via a war. In Deuteronomy 24 verse 1 it says that if a man chooses to enter into marriage with a woman, this is a different tone now. This is somebody who is a part of Israel, who is a citizen of Israel. And so there's a, you know, unlike the foreign woman who comes in, he can send her away, but not without money and not by mistreating her, okay? But in the case of marrying one of his own from within the kingdom, now he has to draw up divorce papers and give them to her and send her out of the house that way. The other principle here is what happens when she goes out and marries someone else, that she cannot return to her prior husband. Then this, of course, is one of the reasons why it was necessary for Yeshua to die for the house of Israel, because only by death is the marriage covenant done away with. And it was renewed through his death and then his resurrection. Had he not resurrected, had he only died, there would have been no way for Yeshua to bring her back. He had to also resurrect in order to bring her back. He had to be able to become her husband again, but he had to sever that covenant through his death, as Paul has tried to explain in his writings. So this is one of the principles of the reason why Yeshua had to die for us, was to be able to renew that covenant that he had with the house of Israel prior to the divorce. And what covenant was that? Well, it was the covenant of Abraham and Moses and David and all of that, you know, all of those prior covenants going all the way back to Adam. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 20, we find that foreigners don't receive the same benefits as citizens of the kingdom and strangers who are in the kingdom when it comes to loans. Deuteronomy 23:20 says, you may charge interest to a foreigner, but don't charge interest to your relatives, so the Lord your God may bless you in everything you undertake in the land that you are about to enter and possess. One of the benefits of being a citizen of the kingdom is to be able to get an interest-free loan. Usury is not permitted. And here it talks about not charging any interest to your relatives, but you may charge interest to a foreigner. Now, interest on loans is one thing, but justice and mercy to foreigners is another. Deuteronomy 24 verse 17 says, "Don't deny justice to a foreigner or to an orphan, nor take a widow's garment as collateral for a loan. Remember to observe this because you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. That is why I'm commanding you to do this." So you see, while there are a few things that a few ways that we can treat foreigners somewhat differently, ultimately, we are to treat foreigners in the same manner as we would orphans or widows, because they have to receive their justice as well. Justice and mercy is top of the Lord's list on how we're to treat people. Okay, now moving on. Deuteronomy 21:15. "If a man has two wives, where one is loved, but the other is unloved, and both of them bear him sons, but the firstborn is the son of the unloved wife, then when he bequeaths his possessions to his sons, he must not give preference to the firstborn of the beloved wife over the firstborn of the unloved wife. Instead, he must acknowledge the firstborn of the unloved wife by giving him double of everything he owns, because he is really the first fruit of his father's strength. The right of the firstborn belongs to him." So, did Jacob violate this commandment? No, he did not, and I'm going to show you why. But let's go to 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 1. Says, "Here is a record of the descendants of Reuben, Israel's firstborn." That's Jacob's firstborn. "He was the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's marriage bed, his birthright was transferred to the descendants of Israel's son Joseph. As a result, Reuben is not enrolled in the genealogy according to the birthright. Even though Judah became prominent among his relatives, that is, the commander-in-chief will be his descendant, nevertheless, the right of the firstborn went to Joseph." Here's the principle. In the context of the ancient Near East, when the rightful firstborn committed treason against his father, like Reuben did against Jacob, the father then has the right to name the successor. Now, this has always been the problem between Judah and Joseph. It is why Judah recommended selling Joseph into slavery. He probably knew that he was next in line because Reuben, Simeon, and Levi had all three been disqualified from taking up any kind of succession. But Joseph had been appointed firstborn by Jacob, as evidenced in that special coat that Jacob made for him. Remember that coat of many colors? That was an evidence that Joseph had been selected over Reuben, and that was the father's right to do that. So there are several principles here. One is that, you know, we can lose our rank in the kingdom. You know, we can be disqualified from a particular service that the Lord has given us. The other principle is that the father is sovereign in the appointment of successors when rank is lost. The firstborns have a particularly important place in the kingdom, and this is another principle. because they get a double portion in order to have the authority and be able to take the responsibility of caring for the rest of the family. And there's more about the firstborns. In Colossians 1:15, says the Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. Now, you see, Adam, we have here this same thing that had happened, where we have the man with the two wives. Okay, we have Adam with Eve, and then we have Mary as the mother of the son Yeshua. We have here a situation where Yeshua becomes firstborn over all creation. Adam was given that authority and that responsibility and that right in the garden, but he gave it up. You see, he committed treason against the Lord by going into covenant with the serpent. When he ate the fruit with Eve, that the serpent gave her, that was a covenant meal, and so he lost his place in the kingdom as firstborn over all creation. So Yeshua came fulfilling the image of the invisible God on earth and becoming the firstborn over all creation. That's another reason why Yeshua had to come and die. There are many reasons why Yeshua had to give up his life, and already in this Torah portion I've explained two of them. So we have this principle of Yeshua becoming the firstborn over creation. And we have in the book of Hebrews, where it talks about the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven. So, after Yeshua becomes firstborn of all creation, the Lord, in His mercy, creates an assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven. It says here in Hebrews 12:22, "Instead, you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, to the heavenly Jerusalem, to tens of thousands of angels joyfully gathered together, to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven." Now that word there in Hebrews 12:23, that word firstborn, is actually a plural word. It is Strong's 44:16. The word actually there is prototokos, and it is it comes from the root word protos, or first or foremost, and it also comes from the root word tikto, which means to produce or to bring forth. In other words, Yeshua's assembly is made up of those that he produces, and everyone that he produces are firstborns. And so we are an assembly now of firstborns because of him. And it says, the assembly of firstborns who are enrolled in heaven, to a judge who is the God of all, to the spirits of righteous people who have been made perfect, to Yeshua, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better message than Abel's. You see, Abel's blood was shed by Cain, but Abel's blood was not able to renew the covenant that Adam and Eve had with the Father. No, Abel's blood, Abel's murder, only further debased the human being's mess that they were in. And so we see here the principle of the firstborn then is a very important 1, and that, you know, Jacob did not violate this commandment when he gave that firstborn status to Joseph, any more than the Lord violated this when he gave Adam's firstborn status to Yeshua, who is the rightful heir to the throne. Now let's go to Deuteronomy 21:18. If a man has a stubborn son who does not obey his parents, and although they try to discipline him, he still refuses to pay attention to them, then his parents shall seize him and bring him forth before the elders of the city, the elders at the gate of his city. Then they are to declare to the elders of their city, "Our son is stubborn and rebellious. He does not obey us. He lives wildly and is a drunkard." Then all the men of his city shall stone him with stones so that he dies. This is how you will remove evil from among you. Then all Israel will hear of it and will be afraid. Now, the principle number one is that, you know, if a parent or the two parents together were to come to the elders at the city gates, this would be an indictment against them as being actually bad parents. They haven't been able to maintain control of their child, and they've been a bad parent. So very few parents are going to want to come and you know, shame themselves in front of other people and allow other people to be able to make this indictment against them as parents. That's number one. Number two, there's no record that anything like this ever happened. And probably it never happened because, you know, they would have to still have two witnesses. Basically, while there would be other people that might have seen this boy being rebellious, it would have to be the parents that bring this rebellious son to the elders. And if they are not able to raise this person properly, this boy or this son, if they can't raise him properly and it's an indictment against them, it's probably because they argue all the time about how he is to be raised. One parent probably undermines the other parent, and they end up with this rebellious son. So if they are about the business of undermining each other with this child, do you really think that they're going to be in agreement when they go to the elders of the city gates? No. They're probably not going to even be able to agree that he is rebellious. One would say that he is, the other would say he is not. And any neighbors or relatives who knew about this situation would be irrelevant because they're not there to witness everything that goes on with this child. But it's this section of scripture, Deuteronomy 21:18-21, is about the principle of rebellion. It's not necessarily about an actual child that is indicted by his parents as being rebellious and a drunkard and so forth. This is the principle of how you put the rebellion out of the camp. You don't allow the rebellion to happen in the first place. You see, that's the principle behind this. And it's a cultural principle because every culture, unless you're totally broken down like the American culture is, every culture has means and methods of keeping children in control. We've lost that here in Babylon now because we have said that our children are smarter than the parents. They can make their own decisions about, you know, ripping babies out of their newly pregnant wombs. They can make decisions about birth control, procreation, and so forth. They can make their own medical decisions. Parents are not allowed to have access to children's medical records after the age of 13 in many states. And so we've given precedence and control over to our children. But in cultures where, you know, the adults maintain control, and we're not stupid enough to say that our children are smarter than we are, you know, even in our movies, you know, the children outwit the parents, you know. In cultures where this was not the case, quelling rebellion was much easier, and it was much needed. If there was rebellion, you stopped it. And that is what this passage is about. It's about stopping the rebellion starting in childhood. All right. Deuteronomy 24:16 relates to this. It says, "Fathers must not be put to death on account of their children's sin, nor shall children die on account of their father's sin. Each person is to be put to death for his own sin." This is a very important principle. We can bear up each other's burdens, and we can take responsibility and even ask forgiveness on behalf of our children and our ancestors, but we cannot die for them. The only person who can die for them is God Himself. This is one of the reasons why we know Yeshua is God, because He is able to lay down His life for us, you see? Our ancestors are not able to do that. We are not able to do that for our children, and our children are not able to do that for us. Deuteronomy 21:22. "If a man is guilty of a capital offense and is executed and then impaled on a tree, his body must not remain overnight on the tree. You must bury him that same day, because cursed of God is the one who has been hanged on a tree. Don't defile your land that the Lord is about to give you as your inheritance." In this principle, respectfulness and mercy to the executed and to his family after death is what this is talking about. But it also has to do with showing us the kind of curse that Yeshua took on our behalf. Because when you're hanged on a tree, you're cursed of God. And so if you leave this curse on the tree overnight, you defile the land. And, you know, because God starts every day anew. You can't have a curse remain overnight, because cursing, being cursed of God and having curses made against you or the one that's executed or whoever does not remain. The reason is because we see from Genesis to Revelation that God is merciful and forgiving, and He does not hang on to the curses that He gives to people. As long as they don't hang on to the curses themselves. You see, if you let the body remain on the tree overnight, that means you are keeping the curse of God. But if you bring that one who is cursed off of the tree, you are asking God to remove the curse. You see? Okay, Deuteronomy 22:1. "When you see the ox or sheep of your fellow countrymen straying, don't go away and lead them. Instead, be sure to return them to him. If your fellow countryman doesn't live near you, or you don't know who he is, bring the animal to your house and let it remain with you until he claims it, then return it to him. Do the same for his donkey, his garment, and for anything lost that belongs to your fellow countryman. When you find it, you must not ignore it. When you see the donkey or the ox of your fellow countryman fallen on the road, don't ignore them. Instead, be sure to help them get up." The principle here is that whatever it is, even though it might be lost, whatever it is, if it doesn't belong to you, it belongs to somebody else, and you're to do one of two things. Return it to them or keep it until you find out who the owner is, and don't go using it and making it like, you know, it's yours. It's not yours. It's a matter of ownership. Okay, Deuteronomy 22:5. A woman must not wear what is appropriate to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment, because anyone who does this is detestable to the Lord your God. It is detestable and abominable to the Lord to mix the genders, to do this transgender thing, I just can't even hardly speak about the nastiness of transgenders and gay and homosexual activities. It is detestable to the Lord. That's the principle here. Again, this is not a new commandment. The Lord is just telling you how his prior commandments apply. Deuteronomy 22:6. When you encounter a bird's nest along the road, whether in a tree or on the ground, and the mother bird is sitting on its chicks or eggs, don't take the mother along with its young. You may take the young, but be sure to release the mother so that life will go well with you and that you may have a long life. You see, this is called the least commandment here, and it's about your mercy. And it's about continuing life. Mercy is what allows life to continue. We want mercy for ourselves, therefore we must give mercy to the very least of creatures. Deuteronomy 22:8. When you build a new house, install a parapet along your roof so that if someone falls from the roof, you won't bring guilt of bloodshed on your house. Here we have the principle of safety. You know, one of our commandments is you don't dig a hole and then leave it, you know, all night for people to go wandering into, right, and fall in. Well, here's another one of safety along that line, because our concern should be for others. You know, like stop signs are showing a concern for the safety of others and so forth. So that is a big Torah principle, concern for others and their safety. Deuteronomy 22:9. Don't plant two kinds of seeds in your vineyard, otherwise the entire crop will have to be forfeited, both the seed that you have sown and the produce from it. Don't plow with an ox and a donkey yoked together. Don't wear material made from wool and linen mixed together. Again, this has to do with purity. The principle here is purity. Deuteronomy 22:12. Sew tassels for yourselves on the four corners of the garment with which you cover yourself. These tassels, and I've taught about this elsewhere, the tzitzit or tzitziot, they are a sign of royalty. The Lord said he's going to have a royal priesthood, and it would be, would consist of all 12 tribes. Well, that got delayed at the golden calf incident, but as I've said numerous times, the Lord will have plan A, and he wants us to wear these tzitzit on our garment because we are a royal priesthood. We just haven't attained that yet. Peter talks about the royal priesthood. Tassels in the ancient Near East context were a sign of being royalty. And so the Lord says, you know, here's this principle. I want the world to see that you are royalty because you are in my kingdom. See? So sew these tzitzit on the four corners of your garments. Deuteronomy 22:14-30 has to do with the sacredness of women, procreation, and the penalties associated with misconduct. We've had other Torah portions that dealt with sexual conduct. Here are some situations where the Lord is saying specifically, using the principles of what would be proper sexual conduct, you know, this is what should happen when you know, a woman is violated. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 1. No man whose testicles have been crushed or whose penis has been cut off may participate in the assembly of the Lord. Furthermore, no one born due to an illicit sexual relationship may participate in the assembly of the Lord, including his descendants to the 10th generation. Oh my goodness, we're in trouble. We've got whole generations of people who are born from illicit sexual relationships. And he says, no Ammonite or Moabite may participate in the assembly of the Lord, and none of their descendants shall be admitted to the assembly of the Lord to the 10th generation. This is because of incest. But here it also says, because they didn't come to meet you with food and water along the way as you were coming out of Egypt. Instead, they hired Beor's son Balaam from Pethor in Aram Naharam to curse you. And so we see here now the principle of, I should say, further principles on the assembly and how to approach the Lord. Deuteronomy 23:21 says, when you make a vow to the Lord your God, don't delay paying it, because the Lord your God will certainly demand payment from you, and then you will be guilty of sin. You know, if he has to come and make you pay your vow, then it becomes a sin. But if you refrain from making a vow, you won't be guilty. See, we've had in other Torah portions about the oaths and the vows and so forth. Here he's explaining you the principle, giving you further commentary on what happens when you make a vow or when you refrain from making a vow. He says, be sure you do whatever you promise, because you have given your word voluntarily to the Lord your God. So again, this is the principle on how you approach the Lord. Deuteronomy 23:5 says, the Lord your God didn't listen to Balaam. The Lord your God turned Balaam's curse into a blessing, because the Lord your God loves you. Here he's telling you that he turns curses that people make against us into blessings. And he says, don't detest Edomites, since they are related to you. Don't detest Egyptians either, because you were strangers in their land. Their grandchildren may participate in the assembly of the Lord. Okay, so here he's making further distinctions. You know, Edomites are the descendants of Esau, who did reject the covenant. Yet he says that the descendants of Esau are related to us, and we're not to detest them. We're not to detest Egyptians either. Now, the prophets tell us that the Egyptians will come to the Lord in the end of days, and that the whole house of Esau will be destroyed in the end of days. There will be no Edomites left. Now, also, one of the ways that it is possible for an Edomite to not be destroyed, well, it's actually the only way for an Edomite to not be destroyed would be to become a Hebrew. This is an example of how when you become a Hebrew, you're no longer what you were before. If you were an Edomite before, well, you're not now. You're a Hebrew. You've crossed over, you see. And so among us, those who were Edomites, they're no longer Edomites. They are Hebrews. But those who have not crossed over, who are still Edomites, they are related to us, and we're not to detest them. We're not to hate them. The Lord is going to take care of what happened between Jacob and Esau. So the principle of this is that family is family, and that the Lord is sovereign in this family, and he'll deal with it. We're just to love people and to be merciful to them. Deuteronomy 23:9. When you are encamped for battle against your enemies, be on guard against every form of impropriety. The principle behind this is that no misbehavior is justified, whether you are at home or at war. Okay, Deuteronomy 23:10. If someone among you becomes unclean due to nocturnal emissions, he must leave the camp and stay outside. As evening approaches, he must wash himself with water. Then at sunset, he may return to the camp. Choose a place outside the camp for a latrine. Include a spade among your equipment so that when you squat to relieve yourself, you can dig a hole and then cover your excrement. For the Lord your God is on the move within your camp to deliver you and to hand your enemies over to you. Therefore your camp must be holy so that he will not see anything indecent among you and turn away from you. The principle behind this is that we have to keep our camp clean. The Lord moves about our camp, and we need to keep our camp clean. This is more on how you treat the Lord, how you approach the Lord, or how you prepare for him to enter into your camp. Deuteronomy 23:24. When you enter your countryman's vineyard, you may eat the grapes to your satisfaction, but don't take any in a basket. When you enter your countryman's grain fields, you may pluck the grain with your hand, but don't put a sickle to his standing grain. So, the principle behind this is that we all have the right to be fed. No matter how poor we are, we have the right to be fed, and we may enter into our countrymen's vineyard or grain fields. So when our circumstances are such that we need to eat, we may do so, but we may only take what we need at that time. Conversely, when we help somebody who is in need, we're to open our hand to him and lend him enough to lessen his need. His job, that's according to Deuteronomy 15, verse 8, but the person giving that we're giving to, the person receiving from us, has the responsibility not to take more than he needs. To facilitate taking care of the poor, we read more in Deuteronomy 24:19. He says, when you are reaping in the field and you overlook a sheaf, don't return to get it. Let it remain for the foreigner, the orphan, or the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless everything you undertake. See, here again we see the mercy that the Lord affords the foreigner, which is the same mercy that he gives to the orphan or the widow. Isn't that interesting? Foreigners, orphans, and widows are on the same plane with the Lord. It goes to show you that he says, you know, we're to take care of orphans and widows. We're supposed to be taking care of foreigners as well. Those who we think are not part of us, we're to be taking care of them. Deuteronomy 24:20. When you harvest the olives from your trees, don't go back to the branches a second time. What remains is for the foreigner, the orphan, or the widow. When you harvest the grapes in your vineyard, don't go back a second time. What remains are for the orphan, the foreigner, the orphan, or the widow. Remember to do this because you were slaves in the land of Egypt. This is why I'm commanding you to do this. You know, people say, well, you know, your God says to have slaves and condone slavery. But that's not really true. Because when the Lord does slavery, he does it so well that no one is mistreated, No one is underfed. No one is not cared for, unlike slaves in the world. So these slaves here that are in the land among the Hebrews are not exactly the same kind of slaves that they were in the land of Egypt. And he wants us to do these things because he wants to show the world that even the slaves in his land does better than even the most well-off people in other lands. Deuteronomy 24:14. Don't take advantage of a hired person who is poor and needy, whether he's your fellow citizen or a foreigner who lives in your city. Pay his wages that same day before the sun sets, because he is poor and his livelihood depends on it. Otherwise, he may cry out to the Lord against you, and you will incur guilt. So, in conclusion, Deuteronomy 25, verse 1 talks about conflicts between individuals coming to the judge, which we just had last week in Shoftim, and letting the judge decide who is innocent and who is guilty and to condemn the guilty person. Talks here about the 40 lashes. He limits the number of lashes that may be given. In verse 4, he says, don't muzzle an ox while it is threshing its grain. Here again is mercy to the least among us. You know, don't keep your animal from eating while it is working for you. Then in verse 5, we have the two brothers who are living together, and one of them dies without leaving a son. The widow must not be married outside the family to a foreigner. Instead, the brother-in-law must go to her, take her as a wife, and by doing so perform the duty of a brother-in-law. That is to be able to carry on the other brother's name, you see. The firstborn whom she will bear will continue the name of the dead brother, so his name will not be erased from Israel. The Lord does not want any of our names erased from Israel. But if the Lord does not want to marry his brother's widow, then she must go to the elders at the city gate and declare, my husband's brother refuses to perform the duty of a brother-in-law in order to preserve the name of his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a brother-in-law. Then the elders of the city are to summon him and speak with him. If he insists on saying, I don't want to marry her, then she is to approach her brother-in-law in the presence of the elders, remove his sandals, spit in his face, and say in response, may this be done to the man who does not preserve the lineage of his brother. In other words, if he does not want to give his brother's child a name so that the brother's name does not cease to exist, so that his brother's name can be carried on in Israel, then this man is to be shamed in the worst possible way. Remember, this is a shame, an honor and shame culture. And to be shamed, you know, is a big deal. Especially in those days, of course, in our culture, shame doesn't mean anything. But shaming back then meant that you were going to be ostracized. And so this brother who would not uphold his duty to give his dead brother a child, his family name is to be removed, it says in verse 10. It says that in verse 11, if two men are fighting and the wife of one comes to rescue her husband and she reaches out and seizes the genitals of his assailant, her hand is to be cut off, to not show any pity for cutting off her hand. Why is that? Well, it's because being able to bring forth fruit is of utmost importance. And she can She can injure someone. In fact, women need to, if two men are fighting, the women need to just stay out of it. But it's about the principle of being able to bring forth fruit and to multiply. It says in verse 13, not to have different weights in your bag, not to have different measuring devices in your houses. You must have honest weights and measuring devices. Because the Lord weighs everything honestly, and He wants His people to be like Him. So we are to do as the Lord does. The Lord is merciful to the foreigners. He's merciful to the orphans and the widows. He has principles by which He upholds the commandments. And kitetse is about those principles of how they're examples of how we can uphold the commandments using the principles of the commandments. So I hope this Torah portion has been a blessing to you. Shabbat Shalom.